and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, we're at a Renewable Energy Alaska Project monthly forum. Recorded on December 7th, Darren Scott from Kodiak Electric, Suzanne Gibson from CERI, and Rich Stromberg from Alaska Energy Authority provided an update on wind power in Alaska at the Anchorage Museum.
Okay, good evening, everybody. I think we'll go ahead and get started. Welcome. For those who don't know, my name is Stephanie Nowers. I'm the Communications Director for Renewable Energy Alaska Project, and this is part of our monthly forum series. It's a series we put on through the winter months on a variety of topics. It's the second Wednesday of every month, except for December, because we know what a busy holiday season it is. And this is just one of many events that REAP puts on to do education and advocacy on renewable energy development in Alaska, to let people know what's happening and also talk about all the opportunities we have here in Alaska. So I do want to take a moment and thank our REAP members in the audience. It's your support that helps us put on events like this. And if you are interested in becoming a REAP member, you can come and see me, or we have membership envelopes out front. And we love your support because it does help us put on events like this. So we've got a packed panel tonight. I want to get to it quickly. I think it's a very timely topic. Wind is our fastest growing source of renewable energy in Alaska. We now have more than 20 communities that are using wind power. Kodiak, you'll hear more about tonight. Fire Island is going to come online next year. Another project that you'll maybe not hear as much about tonight, but that's coming online soon, is the Eva Creek project near Healy. It's a wind project that's about half again as big as Fire Island, and Golden Valley Electric is doing that project. And even though we have quite a few communities that are using wind power now, it's still relatively new technology in Alaska. A lot of these systems have been put in since 2006. So it's a good time to talk about how we're using it here in Alaska, and some of the opportunities for how we can use it more. And even though it's new in Alaska, it's a mature technology in a lot of the lower 48. We're now getting about 3% of our wind power, 3% of our electricity from wind power in the country. Some states, Iowa, as high as 15% of their electricity is coming from wind. So there's a lot of wind power out there. There's a lot of things happening in Alaska. And so it's a good time to talk about it. And our first speaker that we're going to have tonight is Darren Scott. He's the CEO of the Kodiak Electric Association, which has right now the largest wind project in the state and one of the most successful. And he's going to give us an overview of that project and talk about some of the renewable energy vision they have as a utility and how that project has gone. So please help me welcome Darren to come up and talk about Kodiak Electric.
Good evening, everybody. Again, my name is Darren Scott with KEA, Kodiak Electric Association. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about our renewable vision in Kodiak and how wind has been a big part of that. So go ahead and jump in, and I can take questions at any time as we go through, or I think there's going to be a panel here at the end as well for questions. First, KEA's vision. Basically, to boil it down, we've got a vision to be 95% renewable by 2020. We set this vision up several years ago. We knew that fuel was not going to be our answer. Diesel fuel in Kodiak, incredibly expensive, the emission issues, those type of things. Fuel couldn't be our answer. So the board of directors of KEA set this vision for us, and it's a pretty high hurdle, but it keeps us focused, and that's what we've been working toward. And you know, one of the reasons living in Kodiak, I got to thinking of this as I was trying to get up here today on my third time was a charm today on my flight, we're successful. And there's just a lot of weather in Kodiak. The last couple of weeks, I got to spend several days in Anchorage Airport with my seven-year-old daughter and a brand new puppy as we tried to get back into Kodiak due to weather. That was an adventure in itself. But Kodiak's got a lot of wind. It's got a lot of rain. So we want to take advantage of those to make this vision come true. And as you live in Kodiak and you see all the rain and all the wind, you realize that that's a resource untapped that we're beginning to tap. little bit about KEA. First about Kodiak, for the folks that hadn't been down to Kodiak before. Kodiak's, again, an island about 250 miles south of here. It's got about 14, 15,000 people total. Some of its claims to fame, it's got the nation's largest Coast Guard base on it, which is a very large user of ours. It uses a little over 20% of our power is fed to the Coast Guard. And also, about a third of our power goes to directly to fish processing. We've got the third to fourth largest fishing port in the nation, depending on the year. So a lot of statistics here, we've got about 26 megawatt peak load, which again is quite a bit smaller than the rail belt, but quite a bit larger than a small rural community in the state. It might just have a few hundred kW. And our minimum load is about 11 megawatts, and that's much more crucial when we're talking about wind power, and I'll get on that in a little bit. Then what we've got set up, and one of the reasons we can make our vision, is we've got a large hydro plant, at least large for us. It's currently a little over 20 megawatts, and it was built back in the early 80s, and it currently feeds about 80% of our power. Then we've got a myriad of diesels, and we've got three new, brand new wind turbines been online for a couple years. So with that, before the wind, we were about 80% hydro, 20% diesel. So that 95%, again, is a large number to try to go to, but we had a good base to start with 80%. So back in 2009, we installed the first large wind turbines in the state, and these turbines are going to be very similar to the ones that are going into Fire Island. Same company, General Electric. And they've been operating since 2009. And I'm going to tell you some of the stats and stuff we've seen, but overall it's been great. The communities loved the support. I mean, they love the turbines. And even whether you're part of the community that really wants the power price down, and these are significantly cheaper than the diesel power, or if you're part of the community that really wants the emissions down, obviously they're zero emissions. So it's been a win-win on both fronts there. So the project was based on some founding principles. We wanted to use Terror Lake as a battery. Terror Lake, again, is a hydro plant. It's a lake. There's a dam up there, up in the mountains. It's a high head lake, around 1,400 feet of head on it. It's a 5-mile tunnel through the mountains, then drops down to a powerhouse. So that lake there, we utilize as a battery. It's an energy resource there that we can move up and down at our call, our dispatch, to make our load. We also wanted to lower the fuel cost. We knew the community wouldn't support it as much if we didn't lower our power cost. And we wanted to stabilize those power costs. When our power costs were fluctuating, one, with how much rain and snow we got, and two, with the diesel fuel price that was driving some of our large customers crazy and not even knowing how to budget things in the future. And finally, we wanted to lower emissions as well. And one of the things we'd have to deal with, and this is some real live data here, that what we had with our project, let me get this. This is over a 30-minute window of time, and this is one of the things that you really gotta think about quite a bit when you have wind. And we did a lot of work on our system to get prepared for wind. As I said before, the hydro unit we can dispatch, which means if we want 18 megawatts out of it, we can go to 18 megawatts. We want 4 megawatts out of it, we can go to 4 megawatts. Wind, you can cap the peak, but the valley is still there. You can't control it. If the wind goes away, it goes away. And this type of up and down is really hard on our grid. So when you're at one second, 4 megawatts, and really just a very, very short period of time later, in the matter of seconds, you're down to 1 megawatt, 3 megawatt drop on our system. Now take that number earlier when our minimum load was 11 megawatts, that saddle load, we would just drop 30% of our load almost instantaneously. So we had to be prepared to handle that type of event, because electric systems, a lot of ways, always have to be balanced. We have to be providing as a utility what the members need in power. If that gets out of balance one way or the other, too much or too little, the lights go out. And very fortunately, the lights have not gone out due to the wind turbines in the almost 2.5 years these things have been in operation. But we had to do quite a bit of work beforehand on the system. We had to do work from the voltage standpoint, a lot of capacitor banks, and not to get into the details of that, but we had to do things out there to support the voltage on our system. And we had to do things to make sure that our battery, Terror Lake, was able to operate faster. So we did some changes to its operating system to allow it to catch this here. So again, so far it's been successful, but this is one of the things that we can get into problems with. Another thing we do with this, we get in these type of situations, There's software out there with the wind turbines that we can come and cap these. So if we get in a large wind variability situations, we could say, hey, don't give us more than 3 megawatts. So these high peaks are gone and the valleys become less. Gives us a chance to control those. Yes. Question was, is the fish processors causing the drop? Fish processors do cause us some issues, but this is actually the wind power output of the wind turbines. So with that load swinging around here due to the wind, but you bring up an interesting point. Our fish processors on voltage and load, they have some very large compressors for our system. I mean, not for the Anchorage system, but they can be doing the same thing at the same time. So we could have a situation here where load's dropping very quickly with the wind. At the same time, our processors slam on some compressors. So we just lost 3 megawatts of wind, and we just added a mega and a half instantaneous load of compressors so it can magnify the problem. Again, we've been able to keep the lights on through it, but it can be difficult at times. So we try to react pretty fast and try to cap this wind. One of the things you get into that situation, though, say if we cap this at 3 megawatts, everything, if you kind of integrate the curve over time, lack of a better word, anything over this 3 megawatts, we're losing. We're throwing that away. So we have to sacrifice that power to keep the lights on. Yes. The question was the time period of how quickly do we need to respond? And we really need to respond in less than a second. The system frequency with this, all this operates together by keeping the balance in a matter of really less than a second, we can lose things if things go wrong. Fortunately, the turbines, when they go down, they typically don't drop in a second. They drop over a period of, 20 or 30 seconds. So that gives us some time to respond to that and some time for the hydro to respond. But it has to be done automatically. There's nothing, if you're in that kind of situation, there's nothing a person can do fast enough. You have to have automatic systems in there ready to respond and ready to respond quickly. And I'll talk a little bit more as we try to expand this. Keep this curve in mind because I'll bring that back up a little bit. Yes? The question was, since variability improves over the number of turbines, then what made us deal with three? We went through quite a bit of studies early on, and while the variability does decrease the more turbines you add, it doesn't, it's just the percentage of it. So while you might have the potential of 60% with three turbines, you'll have 55% with four turbines, and I'm just making up those numbers. So the total aggregate of load drop we could see would still be greater, even though it would be less per turbine. And with our studies, we did a lot of studies beforehand as well that showed really three is all we could handle at the time, because our hydro plant could only keep up basically with this much variability. We couldn't push it any further. It would turn itself off. So right now, again, it's been very successful over time. This has been pushing about 98% availability. Availability means how often they're ready to generate power. Not that they're generating power 98% of the time, because if there's very high winds over 55 miles an hour, or if there's very low winds below 7 miles an hour, they're not generating power, and that happens quite often. But when they are ready to go 98% of the time, so basically they don't break down very much. They've been very, very effective in operation. It takes a lot of maintenance to keep them going. We're up there every couple of weeks. We have a lot of moisture issues in Kodiak. Probably 98% of the time they're in the clouds, which brings a lot of moisture to the machines. So we do a lot of work, desiccant systems, keeping the oil dry, those type of things, because oil for these machines is the lifeblood of the gearbox, which gearbox is probably the largest failure point for these machines. We generated about 28.5 million kilowatt hours for our system. That saved just over 2 million gallons of diesel since mid-2009. And again, pushing over 22,000 tons of CO2 we've saved as well. So again, we're saving that fuel. And with that 28 million kilowatt hours of power, that's consistent power. We charge our membership 12 cents a kilowatt hour for that power. The equivalent diesel right now is 28 cents a kilowatt hour with the kind of prices that we just have to generate with diesel. So it's quite a bit of savings there. We pass that savings on to our membership right away. And that 12 cents a kilowatt hour covers all our debt costs, maintenance costs, all those type of costs to go along with it. So we're achieving our goals so far with this. And one of the biggest goals that our membership likes to see, again, fuel prices all over the place, but at $3.30 a gallon, the net savings of that delta between the 12 cents and whatever that fuel price or the power price is at $3.30, has been $4.5 million since inception of the project. So that's money that stayed in town, in our community, that hasn't had to go out to pay the fuel bill to the fuel companies in town. So it's been very successful through the process, and again, the community has been very supportive of it. So again, there's our power sources right now. We're still about 80% hydro and 9% wind. We had quite a bit of load growth this year, so that's starting to tail down to around 8%. As load grows, it's harder to get those percentages. And the remainder is diesel. So we need to work, and we're working on some plans right now, actually even further than plans. We're in kind of in construction mode to take and get after that extra 11% of diesel. So this goes back to our vision before of being 95% by 2020. So talking about our next steps in our vision, again, we've got that 11% diesel. We've still got our Terra Lake, and we want to try to expand our hydro plant, and we are expanding our hydro plant. We're going to expand and put additional wind turbines on. And to glue these two together, going back to the earlier question of why'd you stop with three, because Terra Lake can't handle more than three, we're going to have an energy storage system to glue those together. I'll get into a second. Yes. The question was basically, what's the general dimensions? If I could go back here, there we go. The general dimensions of the wind turbines. So the rotor diameter, 77 meters. From the center of the nose cone down, it's 80 meters. And the nacelle here, just this square box up on top, is 122,000 pounds. So that 80 meter pick at 122,000 pounds is why we had to get a 440 ton crane up from down south to do that. It was just too large of a pick. You're at about just shy of 16 feet, I believe, diameter at the bottom of the base. So I think that's most of the standard conditions, fiberglass blading, steel towers, three pieces on the tower. So 122 feet blades. I think that's most of the stats I know off the top of my head. Yes, another question. Yes, on occasion, we use it more for peak load situations or for lake level augmentation. So a majority of time, a day like today, 18, 19 megawatts on the system, we just have hydro and wind operating. Our lake is pretty full. We were blessed with quite a bit of rain this fall, so we're in good position there. As we move on down into mid-January, our fish processing really starts to pick up with some bottom fish. Loads will go up 21, 22, 23 megawatts. With that, even if we've got 4 megawatts of wind going strong and 20 megawatts available of hydro, you can't count on the wind at all, because it could, just like that curve earlier, it could just go away in a second. So we will run, in that situation, we'd run a few megawatts of diesel that had the capacity at least to go up to 4 megawatts if the wind disappeared, because you can't push, if the wind went away, Terra Lake wouldn't be able to have enough horsepower to catch it. You get out of mismatch again, customers go off of power. So we run the diesel right now for peak load situations. And we also run it, we do a lot of modeling on our hydro plant. So if we look like we're not gonna have enough water in the hydro unit, we will run that to keep our lake levels at the right levels to give us the most efficient position we can with our hydro plant. Oh, excuse me, the diesels, yes, the diesels have automatic governors as well that do follow load. And they do help with the that load variability we had earlier. If we had the wind going up and down, the diesel and the hydro units together, if they're both on, would share chasing that. Now, one thing to be careful of, though, and we've had this situation very rarely, we've had it a couple of times, though, we might have to take our hydro unit down for maintenance. Fair enough. Running diesel and wind together, we found is very difficult, because as the wind variability, if it's variable wind, you could push those diesels to very inefficient spots, and then you're back to efficient spots, then inefficient spots, and back to efficient spots. And you start to, one, you're wearing and tearing the diesels a little bit, but that's okay to an extent. But pushing those diesels down, you're starting to really mitigate your savings of wind, because those diesels are becoming much less efficient. So trying to find those right balance points have been difficult, but fortunately we don't have to do that very often because we run our hydro majority of the year.
How often are your turbines not really turning at all and getting no electricity out of them?
That would be pretty rare. Again, you know, over 55 miles an hour is pretty rare in Kodiak. I mean, for consistent, it happens quite often, but not for hours and hours on end, thankfully. And then below 7 miles an hour, there's always a decent breeze in Kodiak. Summertime, you'll see it. You know, July, August, you'll see quite a bit of just standstill. I don't know the hours off the top of my head, but you'll definitely notice it and see it. I mean, I'm looking at them all the time. So you will notice it. Wintertime, very rarely that you'll see that. Okay, the question is really around maintenance of the wind turbines and how do we keep them maintained and what kind of wind spikes do we see in operation. One, we have a SCADA system that routinely or 24/7 monitors the units and helps control them. We also have a contract with General Electric that they watch the units as well, that they can be maintained and controlled, you know, remotely to an extent of what you can do. The wind spikes are not really causing much of a problem for us. They will, if they get too, if the spikes become too robust, they will turn themselves off to protect themselves. We let the wind calm back down, turn them back on, everything's fine. We've not seen any large maintenance issues due to wind spikes so far. We do get some unit trips because they'll look at the wind spikes and go, that's too turbulent. I'm going to take myself off, and I'm taking myself off very quickly. We have to be prepared for that. Again, our hydro has to be prepared to have that. From a staffing standpoint, what we've done is we've taken, fortunately, we switched from operating diesel. It's not new load. It's operating. We switched from operating diesel to operating wind. So we've taken our technicians that were primarily the electrical INC technicians that did the diesel work and such, and we're moving, and a lot more of their time goes to wind now. So we've not had to hire new folks, and we've just kind of internally, you could say, almost transferred folks. They've added to their work scope because they're not having to work on wind 24/7 or 40 hours a week either. So they'll work on wind one day, they'll work on hydro the next, they'll work on diesel the next, and all it did was shift some of the workload over to the wind side. And as far as improvements in the turbines, again, we're seeing 98% availability. But even over the last couple of years, there's been a lot of options that we've added to the units. Some condition-based monitoring we've been able to add to keep an eye on that gearbox. Some other gearbox filtration system we've been able to add to keep that going. Some other vibration monitoring. And as well, there's some new maintenance protocols that have helped to lower the issues as well. So I think they're continually, it's an evolving, as Stephanie said earlier, it's somewhat of a new technology still. So it's always evolving with these folks of making things better to push it further along.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Darren Scott of Kodiak Electric, recorded at a REAP forum on wind power in Alaska. Darren was the first of three to take the podium at the Anchorage Museum on December 7th. You can find a link to his slideshow presentation on alaskapublic.org.
So our next speaker is Suzanne Gibson. She's the Senior Energy Director at SERI, and she's going to come up and talk to us about a project many of you have heard of, which is the Fire Island Project. And in addition to her job as a project manager for the Fire Island Wind Project, she's also SERI's Underground Coal Gasification Project Manager, which is going on. And she has more than 15 years experience in the energy field, and I'm looking forward to hearing what she can tell us today about Fire Island.
Hi, I'm so happy that Darren got here on time and was able to take the first presentation and all the technical questions. Look forward to a time when we have had our project online for 2.5 years and we have all of this operational experience. Mostly very pleased to be here tonight and tell you that the Fire Island Wind Project is finally under construction and we are moving forward. We have overcome some pretty significant hurdles in getting the project going. Unlike Kodiak, we are an independent power producer, which means that we had to go through a process of negotiating a power purchase contract with the local utilities in order to build the project. And so it was a very long project and the project evolved over time. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about that.
Most of you are probably familiar with Fire Island. It's this project is owned by SERI. The Fire Island Wind Project is a wholly owned subsidiary of SERI. The island itself is also owned by SERI. The project will be located on the southern end of the island, which is about 3 miles west of Anchorage, and then interconnected through a new transmission line that will also be built. And that will connect over at Chugach's International Substation. So we also have spent a couple of years in the field. Last year we went out and we cleared all of the roads and the access roads to the turbines. We cleared all of the turbine sites, and we even excavated 7 of the sites that we're going to develop. When we first envisioned the project, we expected to be constructing 36 turbines. And in dealing with all of our commercial counterparties, we had to sort of reassess the acceptance of wind into the rail belt grid, and we had to reassess and decided to reduce the project size to 11 turbines in the first phase. And so we have excavated 7 of the 11 sites. We've mobilized equipment out to the island before ice developed in Cook Inlet this winter, and so that we'll be able to begin construction in the February timeframe next year. And all of that is with the goal of producing power by September of 2012. So I guess I should mention that Chugach Electric is the utility who's going to be buying most of the power from Fire Island. They are allowed to assign up to 18% of the power to Matanuska Electric, and they're working on an agreement with MEA right now to do that. But if MEA decides that they do not want to participate, then Chugach will be purchasing all of the power from the first phase. So as I said, the project consists of 11 turbines. They are the same turbines essentially that they have out in Kodiak, except they put out a little bit more power. The capacity of the project is just under 18 megawatts, and we have a capacity factor of 32.8, which means that we should generate about, on average, 51,000 megawatt hours per year, which is enough energy to meet the needs of 6,000 average Anchorage homes. And we believe that this will offset natural gas demand by Chugach by about a half a BCF a year, which is equivalent to about 4% of their annual gas demand. Some of the things that we'll be building next year during construction include completion of the project roads. The electrical collection system is going to be underground on the island, and then there's going to be an overhead transmission line. We're going to have an operations and maintenance building to house our crew. We will not have people living over on the island. We will hire a third-party O&M provider who has projects around the country, but they will be located on the mainland in Anchorage, and they will fly over to the island approximately 3 or 4 times per week to service the towers. But as Darren pointed out, they too will have a SCADA system and SCADA control from the Anchorage office. And we do still anticipate the opportunity, hopefully, to build out subsequent phases of the project if there are other utilities who become comfortable with integrating wind into the grid. We think that Kodiak is demonstrating that it can be done. We will all be watching, and you know, I'm sure that they're going to be successful. They're already experiencing up to 30% penetration, and they're willing to go up to 80%. 11 turbines for Fire Island is equivalent to about 4% of Chugach's load. So I think that there's a lot of room for expansion. The island, the way that we have envisioned the project, is capable for 33 turbines without interfering with FAA flight patterns. So we do hope at some point in the future to expand it. So one of the other hurdles that this project had to overcome was not only the sale of power through a commercial transaction with a local utility, but also achieving regulatory approval of the power purchase agreement. And the contract was signed in June of 2011, and we requested expedited consideration from the RCA, and we did receive it. I think it might have been one of the fastest considerations that they've ever had to deal with. And the reason why we had to do that was because we're on a very fast timeline to get the project constructed in time to take advantage of some federal grant funding that was available to projects that are constructed before the end of 2012. And so Chugach took the contract to the Regulatory Commission. There was a hearing, and ultimately the commission approved Chugach's inclusion of the cost of Fire Island wind power into their rates. So that's the thing that allowed the project to move forward and us to seek financing. So the financing process was also very quick. It took us about 6 weeks from the date that we received regulatory approval to close the financing. We did that on November the 30th, so just last Thursday. And we're all sort of taking a deep breath and getting organized and preparing for full out construction next year. So we sort of have two projects that are going on simultaneously. The first one, and frankly the easy one, is the wind project, and then sort of the complicated one, in my opinion, is the transmission line that we're going to build to connect Fire Island to the rail belt grid. So the transmission line is approximately 12 and a half miles, and it'll run from the south end of Fire Island to the north end, and then 3.2 miles across Cook Inlet, and then approximately, I want to say it's about 5 miles to get back to Chugach's substation at Minnesota and International. So the current estimate of the contract is, or of construction of the transmission line, is about $28 million, and we expect that the current Alaska appropriation, which was received in 2008, is going to cover the bulk of that cost. It was a $25 million appropriation. There's a grant agreement. Chugach is the grantee, and there's a grant agreement in place, and the funding for that is getting ready to begin. And so that will fund, we have multiple contracts for the construction of this transmission line. We have a land-based construction contractor. We have a submarine-based construction contractor that's responsible for installing the submarine cable across the mudflats. And then we have, obviously, the cable providers and the switchgear provider. And then SERI is responsible for managing the construction of that project, making sure that it gets completed on time so that it's ready when the wind project is ready. And then once we hit substantial completion of the transmission line, that line will be transferred and Chugach will own and maintain it. So we are very proud that we're building this now. It's important economic stimulus right here locally, and we are relying very heavily on local contractors to a great extent. We are utilizing a group called Delaney Construction Group, which is a subsidiary of Tetra Tech. They are the same company that built the Kodiak Wind Project, and they come highly recommended. We're very pleased with them so far. And then we're using, for the land-based transmission construction project, a company called Northern Powerline Constructors, which is a local firm. For the submarine part, we're using Cruise Construction, which is also an Alaska-owned firm. And then we have a huge group of subcontractors that are working with us. Almost all of them are Alaskans, and we expect to have somewhere on the order of 150 jobs created during this process. So the project schedule, we have the RCA approval, we've completed all the commercial contracts for the wind project and also for the transmission line. We're working right now on the civil, structural, and electrical engineering for the wind project. The electrical engineering for the transmission line is completed, and those designs are being reviewed right now by Chugach Electric. We have made our gigantic deposits with General Electric for wind turbines and for the transmission cables. And we are actually just completing the fall field work for the transmission line. So this is a picture of some conduit that we buried that goes out into the mud flats. This is where the submarine transmission cable will come onshore on the mainland side, so not on the Fire Island side, but on the Anchorage side. And there's a big steel pipe down there, and they will pull the cable through next spring. And so that was the first part of construction, which was completed actually yesterday. So we have also some clearing going on out to Chugach's International Substation to clear the route for the transmission line. And it's just, it's exciting to finally be rolling. I can tell you that I've been involved in this project now for about 2.5 years, and many people who have been working with us have been providing proposals and re-providing proposals each time we go back and change the scope of the project. And it's really something to see people out in the field and working, and we're excited about it. So that's just a picture of what it looks like after the trench was closed up. And then in 2012, we'll complete the civil and electrical construction. We'll construct the O&M facility. Again, it'll be set up for overnight in case people get trapped out on the island. But in general, we're going to be controlling the project from Anchorage. In the June timeframe, the turbines will be delivered to the port of Anchorage. All of them will be staged there, and then they will be loaded on a barge, one complete turbine at a time, and transported over to Fire Island for erection. And then we will complete the construction of the transmission line. All of those things are expected to be wrapped up by the end of July, and that will enable commissioning of the wind project in August and commercial operation by September. So SERI is very proud of this project. I think it is a first in so many ways. It's the first utility scale wind project in the rail belt. It's the first utility scale project being constructed by an independent power producer. And it's important because Cook Inlet Region, the company that I work for, serves shareholders who have stake in our region, and we care about providing energy solutions to the community where our shareholders are from. So again, the project will be locally owned and operated. We're proud of the fact that we're contributing to the diversification of energy resources to the area. We think it's really important. We believe that the prices of energy are going to continue to go up, and that Fire Island, the way that we price the energy for Chugach Electric, it's flat price for 25 years, and the net price to Chugach is $97, and we think that that's not only competitive in today's gas market, but it will certainly be proved to be competitive over the 25-year term of the contract. So it does provide long-term energy price stability, and we also are an environmentally responsible company, and we're proud to be bringing this project online.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Suzanne Gibson from SERI. Following Darren Scott's presentation on Kodiak wind power, Suzanne provided an update on Fire Island wind in Anchorage at a forum on wind power in Alaska, hosted by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project at the Anchorage Museum on December 7th. You can find a link to Darren and Suzanne's slideshow on alaskapublic.org.
So our next speaker is Rich Stromberg, and he is the current wind program manager at Alaska Energy Authority. He has a Bachelor of Science in Mathematical Sciences from the University of Texas at Dallas, and a Bachelor of Arts in Journalism from the University of Alaska. And he's got a very varied background. Before that, he worked for Intel Corporation, and he also has a house in Colorado that is a passive solar home that meets 95% of its energy needs with wind, solar, and biomass energy. I know he also has an affinity for puns, so may we be spared from the punness tonight, or you can throw in a few. But anyways, he's going to come up and talk to us as the wind program manager. He sees a lot of these projects in Alaska. I think he's going to give us a good overview of what it takes and what you need to know if you're going to put a wind system up here. So please come on up, Rich, and then after Rich's presentation, we'll have time for questions for the panel.
Thanks, Stephanie. I liked how you described me as the current wind program manager. There has been some turnover over the past several years. I'd also like to recognize Josh Kraft. He's our assistant wind program manager, started this fall. He's coming up to speed really quickly, helping out on a lot of the work we do here, too. So maybe someday, Josh, you'll be up here doing this, but not for a while. This photo here, this is out at Kotzebue, just part of their wind farm, but it's beautiful. If you get a chance, if you're out there for a day or you've got some time to kill, this is south of town on the south side of the airport. It's definitely nice to go out there just taking the views. They've got, this is really the first wind farm in the state. They've been quite the early adopters and trial site for a lot of different things we do, as is AVEC, who's represented here as well tonight, Brent Petrie. But this is at the Kotzebue Wind Farm. Well, they've got about 1.1, 1.2 megawatts worth of wind energy, but they do it at 65 kilowatts at a time. They have 100 kilowatt turbines, so there's a whole bunch of small turbines out there. They are getting some large ones. The foundations are poured for two 900 kilowatt turbines, so just under a megawatt on each of those turbines, so that will greatly increase their system size. First, I'm going to talk about that other rail belt project that you may or may not have heard of, and that's Eva Creek, which is located northwest of Healy. And this is a photo. This is not actually at Eva Creek, but this is a repower 2.05 megawatt turbine, and that's what's going in at that location. They've got 12 of them going in, and so really large. And this will be commissioned by the end of next year. And when it is commissioned, it will be Alaska's largest wind farm at about just under 26 megawatts of power, of installed capacity. Here's a map showing the actual location. And so this is there's an intertie that runs through here, the north-south intertie. You can see the highway. And then Eva Creek sits right up here, and it's fortunate that the northern intertie runs right through the middle of the property. And from an economics perspective, that means you don't have to pay money for a transmission line because it's already there. They've begun work on the road in. There's a railroad crossing at the town of Ferry, so they've been expanding that out where they have a larger space to unload off the rail cars for turbines and cranes and everything. And then the road's pretty straight going in. There's some curves. They've been working on straightening that out, as well as this fall working on the substation, getting that in. And work at the site has ended for the year, but they'll be picking up again in March. So what about the rest of the state? A question I get a lot is, does wind work in Alaska? And this is actually out at Congiganak, south of Bethel. Some folks will tell you a resounding yes. Others will tell you a resounding no. And I really think it's not the right question to ask, because I really don't see things in absolutes. Really, a better way to approach this question is, to what degree does wind work in any given location? And I'll go into some details here of why you need to look at each site as a separate project with different unique variables and constraints to determine how good will wind be as an option. We have some windy places, but not all of them, even with strong wind, are good for a wind energy project. So here's the map that we have. This is a large model that's been built up, and you can see where there is higher and lower levels of wind energy. And the classes start at class one, which really there's, you see a lot of the state in the interior, there's not much wind. It definitely would not be economical. Versus there are some places out in coastal regions that are as high as class seven. And then there's quite a bit in this 4-5 range, even up into class six, and then some class three. And there's some standard, this is nomenclature used by folks in lower 48, but marginal, fair, good, excellent. Some of these things, fair and good, they might apply better to the economics down the lower 48, given that we have higher construction costs, more remote locations, it's more severe weather, those kind of things. These don't necessarily apply to this being a marginal or a fair project in Alaska. We got to look at each location separately. So a wind system should be simple, right? It's you drop in a turbine, you hook it up to the power system, and you walk away, right? How hard can that be? Well, in reality, wind turbines don't run by themselves. You have to be concerned about performance, maintenance, integration with other systems on that electric distribution grid. And there's a learning curve sometimes with each village. So I was showing you how there's class seven. That's a great wind site, a great site for strong winds. Problem is, here's a class wind site up north of Nome that we've tried three times to assess how good the wind energy might be, because it looks good on the wind resource map. And the model is correct when we stick a tower up to start measuring here. Problem is we can never get a full year's worth of data because the icing gets so severe up there that we collapsed towers. This was a 100-foot tall tower that extended up about there, and it just iced up and broke. And so after three different attempts, two on this peak and one the next peak over, we've abandoned this site. So just because you have a class seven wind regime doesn't mean you can necessarily develop a project there. We would be concerned of heavy icing on the turbines and the blades, causing damage to the equipment, a lot of periods of time where you're just not getting any output. So maybe a class five that doesn't have as much icing, or maybe this site's too turbulent, things like that. We want to assess each site to determine, is it worth investing in building a wind project here? Oh, one other hazard. You can't see here, these are some solar panels for a FAA transmitter. On the south face of these solar panels, one of them's bashed in from a muskox that apparently didn't like his reflection. So you get all sorts of hazards up here. Okay, siting is real crucial too. Early on, we want to get some geotech analysis going to determine what kind of soil conditions do we have. What's the foundation going to look like? The foundation is actually a very large part of the total construction costs on these projects. Now this is two ridges over from the previous photo. This is called Banner Ridge. It's northwest of Nome. Here they have good rock, so this is actually easy. I think the worst place found so far on the geotech analysis, you got to go down about 15 feet before you hit bedrock. Just the fact that you can hit bedrock here though is a great thing. So pretty easy to put in a foundation here. Well, it's when I show you some of the other ones, you'll it's in relative terms. I'll still use the term easy, but this one gets a little more difficult. This is out in Kotzebue, and they have permafrost underneath, and there's still things you can do with permafrost. What these are sticking up here is these are thermal siphons. There's piles that go down into the ground, but we don't want the mass of the wind turbine transferring heat into the ground and melting that permafrost. We want it to stay frozen so it's a good solid foundation. So there's a refrigerant in these thermal piles that will keep the permafrost underneath down in the summer months below the freezing melting point. Unfortunately, we have other locations where they don't have good permafrost, and you basically have mush for a long distance down, and you're trying to drive piles in. how deep do you have to go before you get something the pilings can actually get a good anchor into, and you can set your turbine on top of that. It gets really challenging in some of these locations. So this is more difficult, and then other locations may be darn near impossible from a cost-effective perspective. Yes, question. The question was, with refrigerants, does that drive up the cost? It does drive up the cost. Brent, any estimates on how much more the thermal piles over standard piles? Okay, so that's Brent's estimate was another $30,000 per turbine foundation, and that would be like for a Northwind 100. Might be more for this size foundation, because this is a 900 kilowatt turbine. So then we have actually have the mechanical end of what's going on. And what happens in a wind turbine is you're taking the kinetic energy of the wind moving horizontally across the landscape, and you're converting that into rotational energy so that you can drive a generator and create electromagnetic energy. You also need to energy in the system to excite the electromagnet in the generator here. And you have a transmission, a gearbox in some systems. Others are direct drive. And there's electronic controls as well. So that has to be functional, and it has to function at the temperature and other environmental conditions we have. And people have to be able to maintain that too. And then there's the quality of the power that you get out of these systems. The turbine I just showed you there is one of the earlier generation ones that had been running down in California. And back then, these are just large induction generators, and they put a lot of what's called reactive power out on the system. And so it actually takes some power to run these so that they can make power. And there's some inefficiencies in your system. That works okay if you're down in the lower 48, and this is just a small percentage of the total power generation on your grid. But when you're in a isolated village on an islanded, what they call an islanded power system, this can have a big effect on how much more your diesel generators are trying to make up for all the wind power being made. You lose a higher percentage of your efficiency. So better electronic controls can improve that. And then the controller needs to be able to monitor the condition of the turbine at any time. So are there vibrations that aren't expected? Can we keep the turbine pointed into the general winds? Is the wind speed getting too high and we need to take it offline? Those kind of things. Then there's the power distribution system in the community. How robust is that? This is actually some nice new three-phase lines that have gone in Quigilingok, but some communities you'll see power poles at an angle, really heavily drooped lines. Here's another photo of another nearby community. Sometimes the transformers here are way overloaded in parts of the village, or in a three-phase system, one phase is more loaded than others. And these are the kind of things we have to look at and see, do these need to be fixed before we start working on a wind project? Because maybe there's efficiencies to be gained by addressing those issues first. And then there's equipment called switchgear, which will automatically turn wind turbines and diesel generators on and off, select which is the most optimum to use based on how much power is needed by the village at any given time, and what are the minimum maximum levels you can run your generators at, and what the wind turbines are putting out at any one time. So you have to automate this. You can't have someone manually sitting in the powerhouse switching stuff on and on. It just doesn't work that way. So you need these controls, and some villages, they don't have these yet. So that needs to be part of your cost system as well. Then there's the diesel generators themselves. How well are those maintained? Do they have electronic controls, or are they mechanically controlled? If they don't have the electronic controls to respond quickly to changes in the load, which is the electrical demand in the system, or wind turbines that are changing from second to second on their exact output, then that's a problem. You need to get that upgraded. There's also the size of these generators. How big are they versus how big is the usage level in the community? If they're not sized right, you have inefficiencies that way, and you're spending a lot of money on fuel that you could be saving just by sizing these correctly. And then the other consideration is, now we throw wind power onto the system. If it's a significant amount of wind, are these generators now too large for that system? Do they need to be resized? So again, it's a lot more complicated than just, hey, drop in a wind turbine, you walk away. Then we have Arctic environment that they have to operate in and that we have to build the projects in. This is out on an intertie between Emonic and Lackinac. And in a lot of these projects, the driving factor is, well, the cost of diesel fuel is so high out there. Well, it's also, if it's expensive to get diesel fuel out there, it's also expensive to get construction equipment, materials. Sometimes you have materials locally for as far as gravel. Other times you have to ship those in. That makes it more expensive. It's not the easiest environment to build these projects in. So this all gets calculated in. A lot of projects, it's still cost effective to build the wind project. You're still saving money even with higher construction costs. But you got to figure these things out up front. In fact, just with both what Darren and Suzanne was talking about, I hope you got the impression that there's so much time that's spent in the design and planning stage and getting your ducks all in a row and your logistics for transporting people and turbines and construction equipment and materials, so that when you're actually ready for construction, it happens in just a couple of weeks or a couple of months, depending on the size of the project, and then you're done, you have a finished project. But so much more of the effort happens before those turbines even arrive on site. Now here's an example of, this is out in the Aleutians, and here's the village of Nelson Lagoon, and you think, hey, great, this is, we've got ourselves a class 5 and 6 wind site. This should be wonderful. You know, how hard can that be? Well, guess what? This is the wintering grounds for the spectacled eider. So it doesn't preclude having a wind project here, but it means that in the planning stages, we need to do more detailed avian surveys, find out where the birds are, where they're not. Is there a place that we can safely site these turbines so we don't disrupt the bird population? Then there's just risks of working around turbines. Darren talked about how they've got the fencing around their turbines, but in the wintertime, they can still throw ice. If you're up there, you want to stay away from them. Operating on turbines, whether you're climbing inside or outside, there's risks. More times than not, it's kind of cold when you're climbing out here. In fact, I know they lost one turbine. This is Banner Ridge outside of Nome. And they lost one turbine because the braking system had failed on this unit, or something similar to this unit, and it was just spinning freely, but it was too icy on the tower to safely climb that tower and tie off and secure the blades until they could get someone up to work on the brakes. And so, in fact, here's what one of the blades looked like that it threw. So it's risky for people to be up there, and we do everything we can to minimize the risks. But again, some locations we just deem it's not the best place to build a project. That gives you a good feel for how things are out in Western Alaska, and I did that without any puns.
Thank you, Rich.
You've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with Rich Stromberg from Alaska Energy Authority. Rich, along with Suzanne Gibson from SERI and Darren Scott from Kodiak Electric, spoke at a forum on wind power in Alaska hosted by the Renewable Energy Alaska Project. The forum was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on December 7, 2011, and edited for broadcast. You can find a link to the REAP podcast, plus links to all three slideshow presentations from December 7th at alaskapublic.org. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans at alaskapublic.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to alaskapublic.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.